Before I start today, I want to mention something. At our Bible study last time, we considered the question, George is over in Kenya, and he is getting a lot of opportunities to go and speak with new people. And I asked, what would we do if we were in George's place ourselves? It's not something we're typically in situations to do, but George is doing quite a job. There's a lot of people over in that part of the world that are interested in God's truth. They're familiar with the Sabbath. They seek out Sabbath-keeping groups. And George has been doing a fantastic job traveling around and speaking to groups, some in colleges, some are former congregations that got left in the dust when things happened with our group. And what if we produced something that he can use to hand out to these new people that he's going to see? And that's kind of something that we started talking about. And I had prepared an outline at that time, but this outline has grown up now into a booklet that I want to use at our next Bible study, and it sort of outlines the kingdom of God and the truth as we understand it, especially those aspects that are unique to us. So if you're able to come to Bible study, make sure you take one of these. There's several here on the front table. What we need to do now is to go through all of this and add in pertinent scriptures that would help a new person come to the understanding of the basic fundamental message of the New Testament. A lot of what they've heard bears no resemblance to the full truth. So that'll be our project. Even if you're not able to come to Bible study, you might want to take one of these yourself and proofread it, go through it, find things that maybe could be said better or things that weren't said that should be. And also, if you can think of scriptures that will back up some of what we're saying in this booklet. This is going to be a congregational booklet, not one of mine per se. We're going to advertise Dell's booklets in the back, two pages and so on. But take one of these if you'd like to be in on this project. But anyway, that's for this coming Bible study on Tuesday. Most of us who have been watching television lately seem to have noticed a theme. There's a lot of preoccupation with a particular subject of what's going on in the political world, if you can stand listening to all of that. This year is proving to be very different in a number of ways. Both parties have their internal situations. But what is particularly interesting is the situation in the Republican Party that at one time produced 17 candidates, very few of whom ever got any traction. But those that did are seen as outsiders. There's something happening in the political world. American people are basically unhappy with our government. They have good reason to be. Both parties are not doing things the way we would like. So what is happening is what is called the base is beginning to wake up and act outside of what are considered normal conventions. And that puts them at contrast with what is called the elite, or the party establishment. It's interesting how it's shaking out. It certainly bears watching. Who knows what the outcome is going to be? But I noticed in all of that there is a parallel in the situation in the Church of God. We may not have come to that point yet. I hope that a few have. And I'm hoping that more people will begin to see that there is also a base among us. Is there ever a point where that base is going to react to their situation and begin to steer the events towards what we feel ought to be the situation as opposed to what is? Because the church has its elite also. We can think of who that would be. The church has its establishment. Its establishment echelon. Those who generally make all the decisions. And the base is left to follow or not. The thing of it is, that establishment is responsible for the majority, if not all, of the division that exists in the Church of God today. Is there any counterweight to that? I want to point out something that Jesus Christ pointed out to his disciples. It's in Luke 22, about verse 27. Because this is missed in most of our congregations, in most of our organizations, this factor isn't brought into the picture. Luke 22, beginning at about verse 25. And he said unto them, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. This would correspond to the elite, would it not? In verse 26 he says, but you shall not be so. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief as he that does serve. What kind of a picture do we get here? He's turning the situation upside down. The servant class is like the novice, the younger person. How would you consider a younger person who is beginning to enter into some kind of service capacity? We would look on them as a trainee. We would look on them as someone developing their skills. We wouldn't automatically think that they are the top echelon of authority. That's the point that Christ is bringing out here. Consider him as you would the younger person. That's not contempt necessarily. It's not any degree of degradation. It's just simply putting things in proper perspective. But here's the key in verse 27. Who's the greater one in that situation? The person who sits at the meat, who sits at the table eating, or he that serves? Who is the greater? Christ answers his own question. Is not he that sitteth at meat? But I am among you as he that serves. Christ put the person being served as the greater entity. The servants, or he puts them in a lower position. Now, that's not how we do it. That's not how the world does it. That's not how government does it. He puts the person being served, in this case an allusion to his church. The church is the greater entity. Those who serve the church serve on his behalf, and he put himself in the lowest position. Can we get the picture? In party politics, or in government, or in any kind of military structure or whatever, it's the ruling class that is in the upper position. But I want to focus on the base. The church has a base. And that base has a responsibility. It is said that because of what's going on, the Republican Party is set to implode. May be true. Who knows what's going to come out of this? It certainly is an interesting development that's coming along. How that will play out remains to be seen. But the voters are beginning to be stirred up, and it's infectious. One encourages the other simply by an underground movement that is not sponsored by any individual. It's just a base reaction from so many people. The party right now is oriented against itself. Some people see it as being in position to self-destruct. And how it will play out remains to be seen. But the thing is, there are some major structural changes coming. Now, the media is using the word implode, but I would suggest another word that might be more appropriate. We'll see. But is it time for a reformation? There is the thing called the Reformation of the Middle Ages that began to change the thinking of people in a major way. That Reformation wasn't from the top down. It was basically a response among the base. The base. Let's shift that over to the church, because that's the point here. Is it time for a reformation among us in our thinking? And what would the shape of that reformation be if there were to be one? We have a party base also, the general membership, which has long been excluded from decision-making. But those who have been doing the decision-making, how have they done? Are we happy with what they've done? A little over 3 years ago, right here in this room, there was a coherent congregation, similar to this one. One day, everything's fine. And the next week, it's split in the middle. One faction going one way, another faction going the other. Overnight. Now, the members didn't do that. It was the leadership that decided that they were going to take a different turn. They split the congregation. And now we've got one side that is cold to the other side. They don't interact with one another anymore. Overnight. Over nothing, really. But the political party, the elite movement. Personally, I feel the congregation would have been better served to simply say to the leadership at the time, look, you go do your thing. When you've got it resolved, get back to us. But we're not going to split ourselves. But that doesn't seem to happen. And it's been a pattern over and over again throughout the church. That is what accounts for our many, many splits that we've seen. It's not the membership doing it. It's not the base doing it. It's the party elite. If we aren't happy with them, what's the appropriate thing to do about it? The question is there a missing component in our situation? Let's look at 1 John chapter 1. Because this sort of gives us the general idea of how things ought to be. 1 John chapter 1. And this is what can make all the difference. Verses 5 through 8. This then is the message which we have heard of him and declare unto you, that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. If we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not the truth. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another, And the blood of Jesus Christ, his Son, cleanses us from all sin. This is a very profound passage of Scripture. What does it mean to be in the light, to walk in the light? As he is in the light. He ties that condition to the subject of fellowship. We have fellowship, one with another. People who walk in the light have fellowship, one with another. And he ties it to the subject of sin. That's a little deeper into this than I want to go at this point. I just want to point out the fact of the subject of fellowship. People who walk in the light have fellowship. Can we fellowship openly and broadly with all people who share our beliefs? The church right now is structured like it was put in an egg crate situation. Each little group is walled off from the others. One egg isn't allowed to interface with another egg. That's where our approach has led us. Is that how we should be going? Let's go over to 1 John 2, verses 8 to 11. More on this subject. Again, a new commandment I write unto you, which thing is true in him and in you, because the darkness is past, and the true light now shines. He's still on the same subject. He that says he is in the light and hates his brother is in darkness even until now. He that loves his brother abides in the light, and there is none occasion of stumbling in him. But he that hates his brother is in darkness and walks in darkness and knows not where he goes, because that darkness has blinded his eyes. I want us to consider this subject in the context of our relationship with fellow believers. There are people out there, there are people all over the world, who believe pretty much just as we do. Our doctrinal differences, are, if any, are petty many times. Sometimes there's no differences whatsoever. But yet our organizational structure tells us we can't fellowship with those people. One group in particular. If any of their members were to fellowship with us or with anyone not of their affiliation, they'd be thrown out of their own church. They'd be reprimanded. And that's the tool that is used many times. No one wants to be thrown out, so they follow the rules. And to reach over that wall that is built, to have fellowship with someone who believes exactly as they believe on most important issues, would be seriously counseled with, reprimanded, and perhaps thrown out of their own organization for that so-called offense. That's where we are today. The thing is, can we do anything about it? Where do we find in Scripture, particularly in the New Testament? Now, we understand there was a certain amount of exclusion in the Old Testament Israel. But where do we find in the New Testament barriers to fellowship? That was one of the issues that I had with John Pinelli. He didn't think it was at all appropriate that I had a working relationship with more than one congregation. This was a problem. I don't find it's a problem in the New Testament, but it's a problem in our age. What can we do about that? When Mr. Mapes was here, he mentioned something that I told him over the phone, and it apparently impressed him to the degree that he remembered it. But I said to him, we in this congregation don't recognize the barriers that exist between our various congregations, our various church organizations. And I think I'm speaking correctly on our behalf that we don't. We would have no problem fellowshipping with or extending a greeting to someone who believes as we do, no matter what their particular affiliation is. That isn't true everywhere. But there is something in the New Testament that I want us to look at that is perhaps game-changing. And I'm speaking not so much to this congregation on this subject, but to all of the congregations out there who have had a history, who have believed as we believed for a number of years, but happen to find themselves in one of these walled-off congregations where they're prohibited from interactions with other like believers. And I want to emphasize like believers. There are many who claim to be and who have certain ideas that are perhaps not good to bring in, but for those who believe as we believe, for those who have God's Spirit, for those who exhibit the qualities of God's Spirit, why should we exclude them from fellowship? Turn to Galatians 2. There's an interesting incident there. And I was online with a chat room last night, and there were many of those people who have been in the church for many, many years. And I asked them this question, and they all said, no, I don't recall it either. But in my 45 years attending the various churches of God, I've never heard this term used. I've never heard it spoken about. Now, one of the fellows online last night mentioned his background, and he says in his former Protestant church, which happened to be the Baptist church, he heard it quite a bit. But I said, in our congregation, in our denomination, I have never heard it used or spoken about. And it's this thing called the right hand of fellowship. What in the world is that? And why was it important enough to be recorded here in Galatians chapter 2? Galatians 2 verse 9. This was the Apostle Paul speaking of an incident that happened, and I would say it was a formal incident. But he says, and when James, Cephas, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given unto me, they gave to me and Barnabas the right hands of fellowship, that we should go unto the heathen, and they unto the circumcision. What was that that they did? This isn't something that we talk about or do, that I know of, all that much. Extending a right hand of fellowship. Now, this event was important enough that it's recorded in the New Testament. We can presume that this was not the only occasion, but it's the only one that I know of that was written about. What did it mean? What did it imply? And is this something that we ought to be doing, both organizationally and individually? This passage effectively stated the obvious, that there were two aspects to the ministry. Because, you see, the early New Testament church was undergoing a certain amount of reformation in its thinking. Up until that point in time, the ministry was basically to the pre-educated, proselyte, Jewish people. The idea of formally taking the gospel outside of that entity to the rest of the world was a change in their thinking. That wasn't how it was done for the first 20 years or so. We don't know if this is something that was repeated often. We're not told the reason for this particular gathering, and we'll look at that in a minute. At this occasion, something else happened. that was relevant to the subject. Down in verse 11. And this occasion is speaking of some kind of gathering in Antioch of Pisidia, where some of the important people from Jerusalem had come up to address some subject. We don't know what the subject was. The subject of that, or what they were doing, is irrelevant as compared to this act of extending the right hand of fellowship. But it says in verse 11, "But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face, because he was to be blamed." Peter was doing something that he shouldn't have been at the time. But for before that certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation. But when I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter before him and all, "If you, being a Jew, livest after the manner of the Gentiles, and not as do the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews?" Paul confronted Peter publicly. That says a lot about Peter. Number one, he would have been embarrassed for being called out like that in front of everyone else. Number two, it would suggest that Peter was not the supreme apostle for Paul to take him down like that. Otherwise, Peter would have a comeback. He would say, "Well, shouldn't we handle this privately?" There's a lot in the message there that tells us, that gives us the picture of what, how the early New Testament church functioned. There are three incidents that are important in the development to this point. We tend to think of them as occurring basically all together. But there was Peter's vision that we read of in Acts chapter 10, where the sheet came down with all kinds of unclean animals on it, and God said to him, "Kill and eat." And he said, "No, no." That incident occurred in 41 AD. That's the point in time where Peter realized that he shouldn't call Gentile believers unclean. The next incident was at the Jerusalem conference 11 years later in 52, where they addressed the question of whether or not, in order to come into the body of faith, a person, a Gentile, needed to become circumcised. We tend to think these are all events that happened one right after another. They were separated by years. How many years did Peter have in his memory that incident in Joppa where the sheet was lowered down to him? The point in time when he realized that he shouldn't call Gentiles unclean, to the point where they wouldn't even interact with one another. In fact, that colors this incident that's here at Antioch. Let's look at Acts chapter 10 just for a minute, because Peter said something interesting. It explains the situation that existed in the church at that time. In verse 28, Acts 10:28. "And this was the rule," this was the situation in the church up to that point in time, he says, "And he said unto them, You know how it is that it is an unlawful thing for a man that is a Jew to keep company or to come unto one of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean." Peter was breaking precedent at this time. This was something new, that a Jewish man would have direct personal interactions with a Gentile. even though this Gentile was likely a believer, it just wasn't done. The thinking became reformed a little bit at that point in time. But it went on another 11 years before they addressed the question that they did regarding the need for a Gentile to become circumcised in order to be brought into the fellowship of faith. But this event here in Galatians 2, this Antioch gathering that we just read of, was another 6 or 7 years after that. The question is, when was this right hand of fellowship extended to Paul and Barnabas? It had to be after Paul had been accepted into the ministry. Certainly not before. Now, Paul was called on the road to Damascus in 35 A.D. And he says in his own words in Galatians 1 that he went for some 3 years into Arabia. And then it was another 14 years before formally going up to Jerusalem and meeting the leading ministers there. You read of that in Galatians 2, verse 1. So it was at least 17 years after 35 A.D. when this right hand of fellowship was extended to Paul and Barnabas. That would have brought us up to 58 A.D. at the earliest. So the Reformation in the New Testament church was ongoing, and it took several years for it all to take place. But what did it mean? What did they do? It's interesting because this act of extending the right hand has a long history. It still exists today. We seal deals with a handshake. We greet one another with a handshake. And sometimes when we encounter people we don't like and don't want to deal with, we'll decline shaking their hand. There's a certain amount of meaning in that. It has an ancient meaning. It goes back almost 4,000 years. I found this online. It says, the Egyptian hieroglyph of the extended hand represents the verb to give. So if you want to say to give something in Egyptian hieroglyphics, you would have a picture of someone extending their hand, like in a handshake. This symbol finds its derivation in the shaking of hands, which represented the legend of handing over power from God to an earthly ruler. And in Babylon, in about 1800 BC, they find representations of this thing, of the right hand being extended to one another. Now, the right hand of fellowship is not the same thing as laying on of hands. That's a completely different ceremony. In the laying on of hands, it's the elder who would lay hands upon the person being commissioned to some particular office or something like that. That isn't what this is. In extending the right hand of fellowship, one person puts out his hand and the other puts out his. And they shake hands. This isn't one of a situation where one is superior to the other. This is recognition of an equality. And that's the important difference. Those who extended the right hand of fellowship, and you'll notice it's in the plural, they're not just single people doing this, were people who were recognizing the equality of the other person's commission. One focused their ministry on basically the Jewish world. The other on the Gentile world. They were equals, but they had separate commissions. Not that the church commissioned them, they recognized that God had. As Paul said in Galatians 2, they recognized, I want to look at that because I think it's important that we pick up the sense of what it says. Back to Galatians 2, in verse 9. When James, Cephas, that's Peter, and John, who seemed to be pillars, perceived the grace that was given unto me, they recognized that Paul's commission was given to him by God. This was not some kind of political structure within the church. They recognized and they commended one another to their separate tasks. But what's important is that it's a right hand of fellowship. Despite their different assignments, they recommended one another. They recognized one another. They recognized the gift of God to one another. There is no barrier when people are extending their right hands to one another. That's what was absent. The barriers. I want to take that now to the next step, now that the idea is there. What does the right hand of fellowship mean in our time? As I explained, most of our organizations, our split-off organizations as we call them, most of them have erected some kind of prohibition of interacting with other groups. Some more, some less, some severe. Is there any biblical basis for that? I don't think so. But it exists. Now, if one or two people were to ignore that, there might be repercussions. But what if the base did it? What if the membership became dissatisfied to the point where they say wholesale, we're not going to recognize this anymore. You want your barriers? You have them. But we, as the called of God, are going to be willing to extend our right hand to any like believer, anywhere, anytime. And you can like it or you cannot like it. Now, the ministry might not like to hear that because they have something to protect, and most of the time it's just their little sphere of influence or their turf, as you would call it. They think they know what's best. Well, if they know what's best, would we have so much division in the church? Because it seems their method of operation continues to provide division on top of division. It's the result of our way of doing things. My point is that if our base, were to simply say, there are no barriers between ourselves and anybody else who believes exactly as we do, we're not going to recognize your barriers. And you can deal with that in whatever manner you want. What would happen? Well, we know what kind of reaction we might expect from those in charge. They won't be happy. But will they in the long run? Maybe they would. It wouldn't surprise me if there's a number of ministers that are chafing at the bit themselves, would love to do something like this. We have had guest speakers come in, and hopefully there'll be more, from other organizations. We're perfectly happy to do that. other groups that might try it would probably anticipate some kind of thunderstorm within the group. Why? If we believe the same thing, if we have the same spirit, why would we be unhappy with it? But we can know what kind of reaction there would be with our organizations internally. That incident that I referred to here that occurred within the congregation that used to meet here. One day everything's fine, and another day they're split down the middle. And there was some kind of wall between the two groups from that point on. Still is. There's another situation developing, and it'll be interesting to watch. But the CAGWA organization is looking very seriously at merging with Living. There's a particular barrier to that happening at the point, but that man won't be on scene forever. But here we got two groups that, to this point, the members would be prohibited from fellowshipping with the other group. What's going to happen when they merge? An artificial barrier is going to dissolve overnight. Think about that. But if we, as a body, as the base of God's church, if we were to take the position that we don't recognize those barriers anymore, that we are going to extend the right hand of fellowship to any brother that we find who has God's Spirit, who believes basically as we do, what would happen? Wouldn't that be an ipso facto unity? Wouldn't the church become unified indirectly in a roundabout way? Never mind the structural barriers that the organizations put up. If the membership wouldn't have any of it, wouldn't that in effect be a unification? The very thing that everybody seems to want to have happen ever since WCG broke up. There's always been this desire, can't we get back together like we once were? Well, yes, we can. Very simply. Don't recognize the barriers. Be open and welcoming to any and all who are like believers. Wouldn't that work? I expect it would. I expect there'd be a lot of resistance to that from the party elite. But why not? In Revelation chapter 1, there's something that, again, is not emphasized. I think it should be more. Les brought this out a couple of weeks ago. Revelation chapter 1, something interesting was going on. This, of course, is the congregation that is commended, at the same time faulted, for having lost their first love. Revelation chapter 2, verse 1. Revelation 2. Unto the angel of the church of Ephesus write, these things says he that holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks in the midst of the seven golden candlesticks. I know your works, and your labor, and your patience, and how you cannot bear them which are evil, and has tried them which say they are apostles and are not, and has found them liars. Who was doing that? Was that the official ministry that was doing that, or was this the people? Verse 3, and is born and has patience, and for my name's sake has labored and has not fainted. Nevertheless, I have something against you, because you have left your first love. What was that first love? obviously, it included examining the credentials of the leadership. This wasn't the leadership themselves doing it. It was the congregation. God commends them for that. And he warns them against any erosion of their inclination to do such a thing. Their first love compared with their first works. And this was one of their primary works. That they examined those people who came to them and found some of them to be false. Do you think they kept it to themselves or did they publish it? In verse 29. No, I'm sorry, verse 20. This is another church organization at the time, or another church congregation. Notwithstanding, I have a few things against you, because you allow that woman Jezebel, which calls herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants, to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed unto idols. God here is faulting that congregation for not being on top of a situation. They allowed something to happen that they shouldn't have allowed. Again, it tells us the congregation has a responsibility also. 1 John chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. Read this earlier. But if we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie and do not the truth. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another. Fellowship with God involves and reflects upon our fellowship with one another. That's the thing that he's bringing into this picture. Fellowship is important. How can we have fellowship with God if we don't have any desire to fellowship with those that he has called and given his spirit to? Can that lack of fellowship with one another impact our fellowship with him? That's the question. The implication is that it can. The result, we might say, is a weakened church condition because we haven't been doing that one key part. Fellowship involves the thing that we read of in Malachi 3. And this, again, is not something that God speaks against. In fact, he commends those people. Malachi 3, verses 16 and 7, 16 through 18. Then they that feared the Lord spoke often one to another, and the Lord hearkened it and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon his name. These are people who are communicating with one another in things that involve his name. And they shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son that serves him. People who have exercised their senses of discernment, who speak with one another, who encourage one another, who exhort one another as we ought to. That's what fellowship involves. All of those things. It's not just idle conversation. Fellowship has another dimension to it. We fellowship in the Spirit as well. But verse 18, then shall you return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serves God and him that serves him not. That's not a ministerial function. That's those people who are speaking to one another. They're going to be brought back, and they're going to be put in positions of discernment because they've been good at discerning all along. They developed that skill. That's another benefit, fellowship. Fellowship's important. Do we want unity in the church? We'd better have it because God wants it. He doesn't provoke division. It's men that do. And we follow along many times and are led to do things that God doesn't want and we shouldn't want. But we do it. We're used to doing it. We were trained to do it. Well, hopefully we've grown up enough to this point. I won't say this would be a great idea for a novice, somebody who's new to the faith, because how would they know how to discern as they should? But we who are mature enough should be to the point in time when we can with confidence extend our right hand of fellowship to those like believers who ought to be part of us. Forget the barriers. God didn't erect those. Forget about it. But those who believe as we do should be welcomed into our sphere of fellowship just as Christ would accept them. Has he not accepted them? If he has, why would we not? True fellowship involves sharing our common calling. And we ought to be prepared to do that anytime, anywhere. But as we progress into the coming age, and especially as things get tough, we know rough times are coming. But as we progress into the coming age, we are going to be called upon more and more to support one another. There's going to be casualties of the things that are going on. There have been. And unfortunately, we've neglected those casualties in the past, perhaps to our own discredit. How many people could we have helped who were hurt, pushed out, disillusioned, whatever? How many of those people could we have helped had we been in a fellowship mode as we should have been? That's the question. But our fellowship with one another involves, impacts, and reflects upon our fellowship with the one who called us and gave us his Spirit.